Hi, welcome to Civics Change Agent Chat, Episode 10. During these chats, we talk with change agents who are working to create a better health system for us all. I'm Stephanie Spriggs with the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare, or as we like to call it, CIVIC. In this chat, Taman Osborne Roberts, CIVIC's former CMO, is speaking with doctors Indira Lenig and Ken Parsons about their study of spinal cord injuries in Colorado with the Lenig Family Fund. They used co-APCD data to understand the prevalence, costs, payer type, and services used by those with spinal cord injuries. This study is the first step in understanding how patients with spinal cord injuries interact with the healthcare system. During this chat, we learn how many individuals in Colorado have spinal cord injuries, where they receive care, and what costs are associated with treatment. We recorded this chat in November 2018. Thanks for listening and enjoy the chat.
So, hello everyone, and thank you for joining us today at Civics Change Agent Chat. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Taman Osborne Roberts, Civics Chief Medical Officer. Now, before we get started, we have just a few housekeeping items to mention. First of all, the phone lines are muted, and we'll be using the Q&A feature to field questions and allow you to make comments on the discussion. Questions will be posed during the question and answer session at the end, so the questions we receive via that. And also, this webinar is being recorded and will be posted to the CIVIC site, so you may access this information again at any time without cost. That all having been said, we'll go ahead and move directly to our discussion today. We have two wonderful physicians with us. We'll be speaking with Dr. Indira Lenig as well as Dr. Ken Parsons. Dr. Lenig, Dr. Parsons, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Thank you, Taman. So I'm Indira Lenig, a physiatrist here in Colorado, board certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation with subspecialty certification in spinal cord injury medicine. I've been in practice for about 30 years, starting out in academic medicine down in Houston at Baylor College of Medicine. I was chief of the spinal cord injury service at the Houston VA until I came to Colorado. Where I was at Craig Hospital for about 21 years, which is a center of excellence for spinal cord injury medicine. And more recently, I was medical director of a freestanding rehab hospital in Northern Colorado. Okay. And currently, I am a medical director with Paradigm Outcomes.
Fantastic. Dr. Parsons?
I'm also a physical medicine rehabilitation physician with over 30 years of practice with taking care of people with spinal cord injury across the entire spectrum, from ICU all the way to long-term follow-up. And I've been involved in two centers of excellence, one being Craig Hospital and the other the Institute of Rehab and Research in Houston. I've also been involved in developing clinical practice guidelines to try to improve the quality of and consistency of care for patients with spinal cord injury.
Okay, and actually I have to say with the two of you here today, it's almost like we have a little miniature center of excellence, you know, that we have going on right this second. And to that point, if you could both tell me a little bit about the project that you used CIVIC data in, and describe that for myself as well as the viewers.
So the project that was co-funded by the Lenig Family Fund, which is a donor-advised fund of Rose Community Foundation, as well as HCPF, looked at the, it's a grassroots look at the prevalence and health utilization patterns of people with spinal cord injury here in the state of Colorado. The goal of the project was to get a good accurate snapshot of the demographics of people with spinal cord dysfunction here in this state, okay, so that we could inform healthcare provider systems in the state on how to be more inclusive in this hard-to-serve patient population.
Okay, got it. So it sounds like you were really going out and trying to find a way to really understand from the standpoint of patients with spinal cord injury, who's there, what they're getting, and what they're not getting.
Right.
There we go. No, that's really, really interesting. Anything to add, Dr. Parsons?
Well, we've been able to improve the quality of care for people with spinal cord injury over the decades. after World War I, people with spinal cord injury lived the maximum of 2 years because of their complications. And with each subsequent war, the survivorship has improved because we've learned lessons from that. But we're beginning to see a plateau phenomenon where the increase in life expectancy is not as consistent year over year. So we have to take a look at what's happening to these people as they survive with their spinal cord injury. What are their complications and who is treating those complications? So knowing who our population is terribly important as an initial step to figuring out what the needs are out there.
Particularly as it relates to the fact that we do have centers of excellence for spinal cord injury. We've got them in the model systems of care. We've got one here in the state of Colorado in the form of Craig Hospital. We've got the VA system with its designated spinal cord injury centers. And then we've got entities like Paradigm Outcomes, where there's precision of understanding related to best practice. The challenge, though, is that there's a hidden majority of people who never make it to a center of excellence in either of those settings or in the case management scenario like Paradigm. And so how do we disseminate the information to health industry decision makers so that more people with spinal cord dysfunction can actually get excellent health care,
right,
and not necessarily coming into a hub center of excellence, because we're dealing with a hidden majority out in the regular community being seen by family medicine doctors, internal medicine doctors, and ER doctors who may not necessarily know how to make decisions in an efficient, good way.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like you said, there's a hub, and then you have a whole group of caretakers, you know, out there in the community surrounding that hub, but maybe the spokes aren't there.
Right.
To make the wheel turn.
Exactly. And the numbers that we got from our project allowed people to have a quantitative packet of information so that they can make decisions. You know, we can say qualitatively, it's a really good idea to take care of hard-to-serve patient populations, but to be able to provide specific numbers on who's in the zip code, who's in the region, who's not getting the type of care that they need, and therefore showing up in emergency rooms and other high-cost real estate to get their care rather than recognizing things a little bit earlier, managing their condition and keeping them out of hospital.
Okay. No, that makes a lot of sense to me, and I think in part it makes a lot of sense to me, given, you know, that I'm also like you two, a physician and have medical training. Can you give me an example of what you mean by improving their care, giving them appropriate care? Because, you know, I think some folks who are watching may not have an understanding of the wide spectrum of care that goes into taking care of people who've had spinal injury.
Yeah. The case that comes to mind is a 24-year-old woman who sustained a cervical spinal cord injury. She was successfully weaned from the ventilator. She got around in a power wheelchair and a very bright person, and she knew every aspect of her care. That's what happens in centers of excellence. We draw patients from long distances. We have a period of time, maybe as much as 3% of the rest of their life they're going to spend with us, and we have to prepare them for life in other states or other counties at long distances. So she was very cognizant of what her care was, and she realized that her catheter was plugged and she was having symptoms of high blood pressure. Technical term for it is autonomic dysreflexia. She went to a level 1 trauma center emergency room. She told them what was going on. She told them what needed to happen, and it was 5 hours before she got her catheter changed. Mm-hmm. She could have died of a stroke in that time interval. So it's one thing to have our people surviving with spinal cord injury. They need to know what good care is and how to access it. And it's another thing to teach the healthcare providers, the screeners and the primary care physicians, this is what is going on. Listen to the patient because the patient knows.
Got it. So it sounds like there's, you know, really, if you will, an information disconnect. You know, you could have somebody who's in excellent, you know, healthcare provider and, you know, gives great care to a lot of patients, but this is simply too complicated and out of their typical area that patients end up getting not optimal care from a good provider.
Exactly.
Exactly. You know, when we look at the health access disparity for people with paralysis due to spinal cord injury, we know that there are knowledge-based barriers, like Dr. Parsons was just talking about, but we also know that there are administrative and transportation and attitudinal barriers that need to be transcended in order to, in very basic terms, drive down the per capita cost of taking care of these people over the lifespan. An example that I have is, you know, a high-stakes reason for people being admitted to the hospital after spinal cord injury is urinary tract infections or blood poisoning due to a urinary tract infection that lands you in the ICU.
Right.
We know as spinal cord injury doctors that early recognition of a urinary tract infection when somebody is at home simply needs a urine specimen, put them on some pill form antibiotics, and they get to stay home.
Right.
However, I have a lot of patients who have described a situation where they thought they had a bladder infection, but they didn't have transportation to the primary care doctor's office.
Mm.
Or they get to the primary care doctor's office and they're explaining symptoms that they're having, but they're not being interpreted as being a urinary
right.
tract infection.
Because it looks different in this patient
exactly.
than it would in a more common patient in the population.
Right, and so as a result of that, urinary tract infection may go undiagnosed,
mm.
and they become sick and end up in the emergency room as opposed to the doctor's office. There are a lot of patients that I've taken care of over the years who choose not to go into the clinic because they don't want to go through the emotional stress of talking with a doctor who doesn't understand what their needs are. And so we're hoping that the numbers that we have will allow us to address, for example, the knowledge-based barrier. If we can have a curriculum accessible in your app or your iPad so that in real time a provider can open up a screen and see how to take good care of a person with spinal cord injury real time, we're not reinventing the wheel. The resources are out there already. We just need to pull the community decision makers together to invest the time and the energy to make these resources available to providers in the community.
Okay. No, that sounds great. That sounds fantastic. Really a way of you know, getting you know right care, right time, right place, right person, all of that. Well, talk to us a little bit more about the nuts and the bolts and how data is helping you open up these questions and really look at them.
Go for it.
That's an excited face.
What was nice about the data mining that we did through APCD was we saw what we thought we were going to see, which is a large population density along the Front Range. We also saw a large population in the northwest corner of the state, as well as in Mesa County. That gives us an opportunity to partner with existing centers, medical centers, and clinics that may not know who's in their backyard that needs their help. We can have conversations specifically. Here go the numbers that could justify, for example, the funding of a shared case coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
Who can help address the social determinants of health or the barriers to good health care for somebody with a spinal cord injury who may come into a family medicine clinic. They've got transportation issues. They don't know that they're eligible for certain coverage of equipment or medications or supplies. So having the specific information along the Front Range, as well as knowing the medical centers that are in those settings affords us the opportunity to have very pragmatic conversations.
Okay, so it sounds, you know, if I could paraphrase, it sounds like you start with the data. The data suggests, you know, it kind of shows you where the smoke is, and then you can part the smoke and, you know, get down into the fire by talking with people in the communities and the hospitals in the communities and the providers in the communities and say, well, you know, we're seeing a higher rate of, you know, to pick something, urinary tract infections than we'd expect, you know, amongst these patients. So actually, can you give me an example?
Right, urinary tract infections that are being treated in the emergency room,
right,
or with the hospitalization,
right,
rather than in a primary care clinic at home.
So it's not just the diagnoses, it's also, you know, looking into the demographics,
right,
and where care occurred and all of those things.
Right, how to mitigate potentially preventable events that are very, very costly. That is at the core of my concern, our concern as spinal cord injury professionals. There is a way to optimize the health of this subpopulation of Coloradans at a decreased per capita cost with that easier experience of interfacing with the healthcare community. And we've got the clinical practice guidelines, we've got the best practice alerts that we use in our hubs, mm-hmm, that need to be disseminated into the larger population.
Okay. No, got it. And actually, at this point, I'd just like to remind those watching that if you haven't already sent in questions, we'll be getting into Q&A before too long. So feel free to go ahead and send in one or two. So, especially on an election day, be engaged. That is really interesting. It sounds, and then just listening to what you're saying, it sounds like in particular, claims data is particularly useful in this sort of an arena, because as compared to maybe certain other types of data, it's not just clinical indications, it's not just demographics and geography. It's kind of a piece of all of that that you can take a look at and interpret and go, okay, we can see that maybe suboptimal care is happening here, we can see the setting it's in, we can, you know, see where people are, those sorts of things.
Right, we can give hard quantitative data on a diagnosis, a secondary condition, and what it costs when it's not handled through best practice versus what it costs when it's handled through the algorithm that we know in our sleep, whether it's urinary tract infection, upper respiratory tract infection that turns into pneumonia, a red spot pressure area of skin breakdown that turns into a decubitus ulcer, that it doesn't have to do that. If you know how to guide a practitioner on early recognition and intervention, it's about the numbers. It's not a feel-good concept, and that's why the database is so valuable, because you can compare the claims in a center of excellence versus out in the wilderness, and see if we make certain changes out in the wilderness, how the fiscal and clinical outcomes can be optimized so it matches what best practice looks like in the world that we live in.
Kind of, you know, taking it out of, if you will, center of excellence, a petri dish, and seeing what it looks like out in nature.
Yeah, or at centers of good enoughness.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So this is fascinating. Where do you see this going to? Where do you see next steps for this being? You talk about the quantitative data being particularly useful. How? What would you use it for? How does this move the needle on the ground or in, you know, policy or administration, other places?
Excellent question. Step one is take the information, share it with local healthcare provider entities here in Colorado. Simultaneously, one of our national organizations, the American Spinal Injury Association, which is an organization of spinal cord injury researchers, clinicians, and industry partners, we already have an ad hoc committee looking at primary care for people with spinal cord injury. We will be using the data from this project as well as data from other settings to create the platform for sharing the information with providers, whether it's at their national level meetings or on the local level here in Colorado or other states.
Got it. So it sounds like you can finally talk to people and say, okay, this is not us talking about it. These are real numbers we have it. And then you can go from there and say, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? Well, let's take, you know, the lessons this is telling us. build a platform, use it to recruit providers from throughout the communities to help and build a curriculum to help them actually get these patients better care. Am I hearing that right?
Right, and the framework, which is why, you know, having Civic as a collaborative partner is so powerful, is the conversation is within the metrics that matter of the triple aim. These are very objective numbers that can be measured, and it's not just for our subpopulation.
Got it. So it sounds like you could imagine this model being applied to a range of different conditions, you know, and a range of different medical areas and specialties.
Specifically, the parallel group of other disabilities that have a mobility barrier. You know, they're paralyzed in a wheelchair, so that the average provider is having challenges not only with the constellation of clinical conditions related to the diagnoses, but just the mechanical, like how do I get this person into an examining room? How do I weigh them for their congestive heart failure if I don't have a roll-on scale? How do I get them up onto an examining table if I don't have somebody who can help this paralyzed person up onto that examining chair? And that's an issue for the aged population as well.
No, that makes sense.
About one in four or one in five people with spinal cord injury are women. And accessing gynecological care when the typical examining table is here and she's sitting down here.
Right.
And who's going to lift her up on the table
right.
and position her safely
right.
for her examination? So that's one population that, you know, having one table in the office suite that drops down to wheelchair height would solve that problem. Another approach, and I like to think about this as how you bring about change in physician behavior. We learned a lot from our clinical practice guideline process, because once we published the documents and they were widely distributed, but they weren't applied. They were just put on the shelf. That was back in the days of hard copies. Now they would be somewhere in a file on your iPhone. But would you know to look? And if you're sitting in the emergency room and a person comes in with a blood pressure of 150 over 80, is that a real emergency? Well, it is if their normal blood pressure is 90 over 60. And so they're actually, you know, in a dangerous blood pressure range for themselves. So helping physicians who've never encountered a spinal cord injury patient before, helping them understand the differences in physiology. Dr. Leneg mentioned the issue of respiratory infections. Respiratory complications are the most common cause of premature death after spinal cord injury. And the reason for that is they can't cough. If their paralysis is in the chest and in the abdominal area, they can inhale pretty well, but they can't develop a strong cough.
Right.
So a simple upper respiratory infection and the congestion that follows and so on and so on ends up being a trip to the emergency room and then into ICU and intubation and on a ventilation, totally preventable.
When we talk about a physician being able to make a good decision based on what they see in their app, or if we have a best practice alert in the electronic medical record, before that can happen, particularly if a physician is an employee of a system, the system needs numbers to create an environment of success for an individual provider.
Got it.
Carving out the time for grand rounds or other CEU forums so that their base knowledge is elevated. The resources necessary to customize the electronic medical record that the individual physician is using when he or she is seeing that person with a spinal cord injury. That's where the data from our data mining is useful. It's for the healthcare service providers on an institutional level so that they've got the numbers so that they know how to allocate FTEs or time or objectively look at return on investment as they serve this subpopulation of Coloradans.
So it's the numbers that really drive the systems change, you know, because quality is okay. If somebody talks to a colleague, they might change their practice, but they might not be able to change the practice if the system they're working in doesn't have time for them to have the appropriate education or wants to spend the money on the appropriate infrastructure, like, say, a table that would lower to an appropriate height, or any of those things. But if you can say you're spending this much more per year than you have to be taking care of these people and they're getting worse care, there's a win-win here. If we make these minor investments, you know, you can really move the system and get people to actually change care, both at the clinical operational level, but also at the level of how things get paid for. And those decisions aren't always made by clinicians. You know, folks are looking at dollars and cents at that point.
And we actually have a question that dovetails nicely into that. I'm going to modify it a bit because as it came in, you answered a portion of it. but our attendee wants to know, if there's one thing that you hope providers and payers would do based on the work and research you're doing, what would it be? Now, you've answered the provider section very well, but I would be interested to hear what you said about payers and how your work and research can help those insurance folks.
One of the good things about recent developments in healthcare has been access and being able to access health insurance of one form or another with a pre-existing condition. The pre-existing conditions are very scary to payers, because utilization, assuming that we don't make some changes in the system, utilization is very expensive and high risk. So when, to me, now most of my work is in the workers' comp arena, and major workers' comp payers understand that optimal care in the short term is much cheaper in the long term. You prevent complications, and you teach the patients how to avoid those complications in the future. Dr. Lenig mentioned pressure sores. That's the most expensive complication that can happen after spinal cord injury, because it's very hard to heal a wound in an area of the body where you don't have sensation. And so people don't stay off it. If it were a blister you got while running, you'd stay off it.
Right.
But this is way more complicated when there's no sensation. So recognizing, helping the payers to recognize that that good care up front when things are simple and the long-term complications are preventable, it prevents hospitalizations, it prevents expensive urinary tract infections, it prevents pressure ulcers.
And again, the best practice models that work are already out there.
Yeah, right.
But oftentimes they are not... they don't have the secret decoder ring words that payers say, we'll pay for that. But in our world of subspecialty excellence, we know what works. And if payers could understand the federal government endorses these best practices in their federally designated centers of excellence or the Department of Defense, SCI, centers in the VA system, why cannot those practices be paid for in the larger hidden majority of Medicaid, Medicare, private sector?
Got it. It sounds like the numbers open up a conversation
in
the way that
that
you know payers will listen. You know.
Right. And it ties into know what the P. Peterson Healthcare Center shows, which is there are models that work. If we direct attention to them, we can learn and replicate them in areas where they're not being implemented yet.
Well,
the electronic medical record and its ability to raise a flag when somebody comes in with a diagnosis, maybe their secondary diagnosis, spinal cord injury, and they come in with a fever, an electronic medical record can be fine-tuned for the emergency room or physician's office. Think about lungs. Think about urinary tract. Think about thrombophlebitis. That can cause fever, etc. somebody who has no sensation. Just the functionality of the electronic medical record can actually improve the quality of care.
Well, you have both presented, you know, some amazing, you know, work today for a population that really, really, really will benefit greatly from what you're doing. Any closing thoughts as we come to the end of our conversation?
And thank you to Civic for being a great partner.
We're very, very thankful that we can be a partner with you and continue to help improve health for these Coloradans and really make their lives better and longer and happier. And with that, we actually have come to the end of our time together. I'm sure you'll agree with me, this has been an incredible discussion, and I'd like to thank both Dr. Ludwig and Dr. Parsons for joining us here today and telling us about the amazing work that they're doing. Thank you to all of you who joined us as well. And once again, I want to let you know that this recording will be shared via social media and the Civic website in the coming days. Our next chat is Tuesday, December 11th, when we chat with Orderly Health about how they're using data to change digital health. Thank you so much, and have a great day.